I want to welcome everybody back to ClimateCast Live. I'm meteorologist Paul Huttner, your humble weather host for the evening. Let's bring everybody back. Jessica Hellman, Radhika Fox, Mark Seely, come on back. Let's have a little chat here. Welcome everybody back, please, if you would. So here's a softball, right? Right away, we'll just toss that out. I don't know who wants it, but is there enough discussion about solutions? One of the things that, you know, has been interesting to me to watch the trajectory of ClimateCast from when we came on the air 5 years ago is, first it was like, oh my God, there's this huge climate problem. Then it was like, okay, everybody gets, or at least more people get, that there is a big climate problem. And now it's like there's all these really cool solutions, and they're happening faster, some of them, than people projected. So what do you think? Do we talk enough about the solutions?
I'll just volunteer an observation in that regard. Last May, here at the River Center in downtown St. Paul, we were privileged for the first time to host the National Adaptation Forum. We had all 50 states represented there. We had over 1,200 attendees, and we heard from practitioners of adaptation, be it public works departments or city councils or transportation services, utility providers, public health officials, a whole gamut. And I think that this kind of a forum is deserving of more attention. This occurs about every other year. It's a national meeting, but it's through the sharing of our practical application of our knowledge and what works and what doesn't that we gain a lot from each other. And I wish in some respects that the national media had covered that national forum last May a little bit more than it did, because I think things like that, venues like that, are really very, very worthwhile.
I see, Paul, we do know on the mitigation front pretty much exactly what the solutions are. It's, in that sense, climate change is a really simple problem. It's really very simple, right? You have these greenhouse gases, we're adding them to the atmosphere. The concentration of them increasing is warming the planet. So first we have to stop adding them. So we have to reduce how much we add, and then eventually we have to add zero. So we can calculate exactly how much carbon we emit now and how much we must stop emitting in order to get to zero. And then you can back calculate how you're going to do that. How much of that is going to be wind? How much of it is going to be solar? And then the tricky part, so the solutions and the technological solutions mostly exist, right? I drove here today in an electric car that exists. You can buy it in the market. I have solar panels on my roof. The tricky part about the solutions is the deployment, it's the financing, it's making it accessible to all people, it's building political will for it. And then I think we also, on the adaptation side, we have a lot of solutions, but we can't quite do that same math where we figure out exactly the magnitude that we need and then calculate what the parts are to get it.
You know, at the U.S. Water Alliance, we say that the water challenges that our nation faces are tremendous, but our capacity for innovation is even greater. And we certainly see that with the communities we work with around the country. And I think that the solutions frame and focusing on solutions is so important, because really what we're asking people to do is really embrace complexity, right? It's doom and gloom if you look at the numbers around climate, and Mark and Jessica know those numbers well. And so how do you help people understand the urgency of the problem but not feel hopeless? And that's why we always pivot to what the solution is, and that everyone is part of the solution. That's what we do at the U.S. Water Alliance, right? Farmers are part of the solution. Young people are part of the solution, as we've been hearing this evening. Utilities, environmental groups. So to own that we are all part of that solution, and we have to work together to get there.
I want to talk about corporate America for a minute, because I got to tell you, that's in a lot of ways one of the places I see optimism. We have interviewed many, many corporate executives on ClimateCast over the last few years who are actually seeing climate change show up either in their supply chains or in their extreme weather disruptions or in their business models. And we're seeing a lot of companies begin to institute-wide sustainability programs around climate, they're also getting demand, consumer demand, to be more climate-friendly, more climate-responsible. What have you guys observed there, and how do we reconcile that with what seems to be the glacial pace of government?
I have to say that with this last election cycle, I have been so impressed with parts of corporate America and how they have stood up and reaffirmed their commitment around climate, just as, for example, my governor, Governor Brown in California has. And it really is tremendous. And it's a both, I think, for a lot of these companies, for example, Dow based here in Edina, their water stewardship report, it is both bottom line business sense for them because they recognize we are not making the chemicals and other things that we make if we don't have clean access to water, et cetera. So it's a bottom line business decision, but I think it's also sort of keeping an eye on the future, right? So I think as our current administration has backed down, I think we've seen a lot of corporate America step up, and that's we should be applauding them for that.
Yeah, they also, right, this is a global economy. So the American political system is, in essence, lagging the global economy. I think a lot of private industry sees innovation opportunities, emerging markets dealing with some of these challenges around the world, and is actually asking government to provide some parameters around which we can really develop our businesses. I think actually this is one of the unspoken sort of scary parts of a failure to recognize climate change and other global forces is actually potentially a market failure, in that other economies will beat us in that solutions and innovation space. And so, we need to be cognizant of the economic opportunities that come with getting on board.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in China to a degree. They are really the world's leader now in solar production, and that is a huge economic opportunity. We talk about that too. Mark, I know, how do you reconcile that with, we've pulled out of the Paris Accords here. It seems like our government has gone backwards and is even in some ways placing bets on fossil fuels, or trying to. There are obviously those lobbying forces. How do we move forward as Americans in that landscape?
Well, I think at the local level, community level in Minnesota, we have some shining examples. I've had the privilege of serving on the Climate Adaptation Partnership Awards Committee the last several years. We've had nominations come in from all over the state. One area or sector that I see particular attention being paid is in the renovation of decayed or old infrastructure, and or the deployment of new infrastructure, in other words, facilities management and design. And there's tremendous efforts to look at sustainability practices, conservation practices. How do we conserve energy? How do we conserve water? How do we handle our waste better, et cetera, et cetera? And how do we deploy more renewables in the use of whatever the renovated or new structure is? There's been tremendous work being done, and there's lots of stories like that throughout Minnesota that I see coming up. And now these are at the community level. So I think that over time we're going to see more and more of this type of, it's almost like, what do we want to say, corporate role modeling. Mm-hmm. From smaller scale all the way up to the grand scales, the big companies like you've mentioned earlier. And I really see that as having a lot of momentum to it. And that's going to migrate upward in its political influence in our system of government here, I think.
I'm amazed at how quickly some of that mindset has shifted in the past 5 years or so. Radhika or Jessica, what do you think that landscape is now as we look forward the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm not from Minnesota. I am a Midwesterner, but I've been here now a few years, and I am really drinking the Minnesota Kool-Aid. And that I think, with all due respect to California, that's doing amazing things, I actually think we have enormous opportunity for leadership. And so when I look 5 years ahead, I think there's going to be a lot of action in this state across sectors, ag, electricity. We got some really amazing leadership in the electric utilities. And so I think other states in our region and otherwise will be looking to Minnesota. We've got a better political environment and a willingness, at least in Minnesota, to say we're going to decide for ourselves what is appropriate. We're not going to necessarily fall into the national rhetoric. So that's my five-year hope about the action that we'll see in this state and the other people who will follow.
Radhika, what about you? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I think if we look out 5-10 years and you know, the future of America, it is going to be the choices we're making now around our water, climate, energy, all of these things. And, you know, what I hope we can all do together is really flip the script, right? Mm-hmm. That help people understand that our water systems are at risk and that puts our nation at risk, that all of the impacts of climate, et cetera, but that actually offer a positive vision of how we can actually recover stronger and be more resilient, right? And how do we treat some of these very visible crises? You know, Puerto Rico, where 1 million people without water, what's happening in Houston right now, they're not just trying to rebuild to what they were, but having a vision around rebuilding stronger and better. So that's my hope for this nation around water and climate in the future.
What's one thing, Mark Seeley, that everybody in this room can do to either educate themselves or make a positive impact with regard to climate change?
I think I fall back on, it's kind of a classic Minnesota answer, but we all as individuals have spheres of influence. They exist within our family, our community, all the various professionally and personal communities that we interact with. And the very bottom line, the very minimum we can do is role model, live our lives in a way where we explicitly give attention to this and we pay attention to our carbon footprint, our water footprint, our waste footprint, etc., and that people around us see us living in that manner. That's an absolute minimum, but it's something that everybody can do.
Are you optimistic, Jessica, Radhika, as you look forward? What are you most hopeful about?
I think the thing I'm most hopeful about as a national organization, I am so lucky to be able to work with communities all around the country. And what excites me is how people are coming together. They are uniting. They're really trying to stretch beyond the differences that we see to find these common ground solutions around water security and climate security. And so it's really people that give me optimism and what's really frankly happening at the local level.
Jessica, how about you?
I'm hopeful about things becoming readily available in the marketplace. I think that a lot of the climate solutions that we talk about and the ways it's a little bit easier to answer what you can do question now than it was even a year or two ago. I'm excited that, I mean, I think the future, the electrified future is an exciting one. I think there's economic opportunity. So I think that we can make choices as consumers. Again, we have to pay very careful attention, though, that everyone gets to participate in that future economy and the economic opportunity. But I'm excited about wind and solar coming to Minnesota, things like that.
Great answers, you guys. Great perspective. We also have this room full of wonderfully smart, curious, engaging people. So I want to get some questions from the audience, if we can. Sir, looks like you're first. Thank you.
Say your name, I'll hold the mic.
Todd from St. Paul.
Hi, Todd.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for all this and everybody here. And I might just say that you're my favorite meteorologist.
Thank you for that.
Mainly because of ClimateCast. And that is the question. There's 4 meteorologists on TV, and I do not hear them once in 365 days talk about climate change, talk about the most important aspect of why we're all here together. How do we change that? I've spoken to 3 of them, and I've gotten blank stares. Even at the state fair with Belinda Jensen, who you know, she would not even engage in the conversation about how she needs to bring out that on air. She needs to talk about it and encourage the population to think more about that. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a That's a great question. And you know what? I can tell you this. There is a lot of talk right now in my professional organization, the American Meteorological Society, and was at this year's annual meeting about how responsible should AMS members be who are TV weathercasters in talking about climate science. The AMS has a statement on climate change. It's very clear and unequivocal that humans are causing at least part, making a contribution to climate change. And there are many of us in the field who feel like if we're an AMS member, it's our responsibility to talk about climate change and report on that science, just as it is to report on weather science. So there are conversations around that. The obvious fly in the ointment for many ownership groups and TV stations and meteorologists is, why do I want to alienate 30 or 40% of my audience by talking about something that they either don't agree with or don't understand or don't accept? So those are conundrums. It's one, thankfully, I've been lucky. I did TV for 20 years before I worked here at NPR. I've been lucky with my ownership groups that they've allowed me to report on that. I've been reporting on climate science on the air since the late 1990s. But it's a problem. I'm probably one of the more radical members of my profession that thinks that if you have an AMS seal, you should be required to report on climate science. You don't just get to pick part of the science that you report on.
Paul, I've got a question from Twitter.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth.
From Cody. Actually, I'm just going to have Cody read it.
So this is from Timothy Edward Nixon. Are you here, Tim? Timothy? There we are. So some climate-denying politicians say change is happening and humans are partially responsible. So what is problematic with this new spin and how to respond?
Tim Nixon with Thomson Reuters.
Let me try to clarify a little bit.
That Twitter thing, you know.
So I think there's this issue of partially responsible, and it's a huge potential sort of range of responsibility, right? And it's creating sort of doubt and fog around, well, what is the human role? Do we really know how much humans should even be sort of taking a role in the solution? And I'm seeing that as sort of a new spin on sort of delaying action. So I wondered how you would sort of respond to that. I've heard it from some of our gubernatorial candidates and also at the EPA today. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think part of this is going to get solved in the courts because we're seeing more and more climate change lawsuits coming out. We're seeing a case for reparations, climate reparations being made. We're seeing major cities like San Francisco, the Bay Area, suing fossil fuel producers. I think there's always going to be that segment of the U.S. political landscape that is going to, in one way or another, try to push off solutions, try to deny the science, and that's terribly unfortunate. I'm just hopeful that we're reaching a critical mass to the point where we're starting to see the impacts of this more and more. When parts of the southeast U.S. coast, they've now measured 5 inches of sea level rise in the last 5 years, we're seeing these impacts come home to roost. And I guess that's where my hope lies, is that we're going to change enough minds soon enough. And we're not going to change everybody's mind, but there's going to be people who are seeking to be made whole from the changes that we're seeing.
You want to add too? Good question. Okay, I'll go real quick. I was at 3M yesterday, and I saw the Nobel laureate from 1995, Mario Molina, was in town. And he, one of his slides that he brought up there was the latest IPCC report, and he really described it in probabilities, right? So the way that he told people to think about it is that there's a 95% chance that humans are causing this. So that's the way that he put it. But Jessica can probably do even better than that.
No, that's good. I just, we talked a little bit earlier about the climate community becoming even a little bit more savvy about how to talk about science. It's extraordinarily easy to exploit that uncertainty. Well, there's 5%, you know, 5%, I don't know, maybe. But I think that, and I don't know the specific reference, I don't actually know what the gubernatorial candidates, for example, have said recently, but I think in the way that you're expressing it is to say that that's just downright disingenuous, right? It's not true. It's not accurate. Are there factors that cause climate change that have nothing to do with people? Absolutely. It's called the ice ages, right? But what we are talking about on this time horizon, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there is no other factor that can explain the changes in climate that we have observed on this time horizon. Now, if we all have the privilege of living for another 40,000 years or so, then we can talk about the other factors that also influence climate. And there are other interesting climate factors that are important, too, like volcanoes that we can study and think about, you know, how we can learn how they influence climate. Maybe there's something useful there. You know, that's another controversial topic. But to say, oh, we don't know, is to on purpose manipulate what confuse what we do know and what we don't know. And I think as a climate community, we have to call that out. And it's not fun. And it gets a little old, but you have to just say it over and over and over again.
I would also just add that, you know, the people who are here in this room tonight, you care about the future of your community. You care about the future of America. Why else would you come at 7:30 at night to talk about climate change, right? So I just also think it's really important for all of us to stay focused and disciplined on the solutions, because we could waste a lot of our time around constantly trying to respond to the climate deniers. And what I would say is, you don't need to call it climate change, but, you know, if it poor people in Miami live in a place where it is a sunny day and their neighborhoods are flooding, like, let's talk about that. I don't care what you call it. Let's talk about the fact that one in 30 wells have run dry in the western states. Let's talk about what we're going to do to make sure that people have safe, clean access to water. And so I say we have to have discipline as those who are stewards for our communities and for this country to focus on the solutions.
Yeah, I feel like the train's leaving and we don't need everybody to get on. Yeah. And some people won't get on.
Yeah.
But we're still going.
Go.
Sir.
So,
Ron, you say your name.
Ron Albrecht from West St. Paul. So my question to you is, what can all of us go home and try to do to make this a better planet?
I like Mark's idea. Talk to your friends, your family, your neighbors. One of the walk the talk things that I've done in my life is I opted to go 100% wind for my home electricity. That's an option you can do. That's something you can do tomorrow. You know, if people are in a position to do that, obviously you can change the transportation that you're using to a more climate-friendly vehicle. Transportation and electricity are the two biggest CO2 emitters. So those are the two places you can make the biggest impact. And I also like the notion of talking to your city. The more people here demand on climate action, the more response we're going to get.
I would say vote. I mean, we have a major election cycle coming up. And hold your policymakers accountable.
Many communities are going through, they either, as our young people have already alluded to, they've either already gone through the process of a climate action plan, or they're in the midst of it, or they're contemplating doing so. And that's a community level of engagement that everybody can get engaged in. And besides the role modeling, I'd like to throw one maybe broader perspective into this. And I think with the threat that we've seen in the last year or more emerge in our own American landscape that shows great disrespect for science in general, not just climate science, science in general, we need to be very sensitive to that, and I think we need to teach our children and those we associate with that the reason we've evolved to the way we've evolved is because of a huge knowledge base that's been generated by science, and we can't leave that behind. We've got to have respect for what science can do for us across the board, not just climate science.
Let's see if we got time for a couple more questions here from the audience.
All right. Say your name, please.
Okay. Hi. Rocky DiGiacomo. Not so much a question as a comment. Someone down here in the front row asked a question that I've heard asked at any number of these forums, what can I do? And the panel often reacts, as I heard this panel react, gee, I'm not sure. And I'm quite certain we can all act as individuals because we're lucky enough to live in the state of Minnesota where buyback is required by the electric utilities. Now, what that means is that if you put solar panels on your home, then you don't have to have another $25,000 worth of batteries in your basement. All you got to do is have the panels. And that means whether you're using the electrons or the surrounding homes in your neighborhood are using those electrons, the generation is being used 100% of the time. That turns the electric utilities into a system, not so much as generators. It means all of us can become micro producers. And the paybacks on that work. They're not great, but they work. And the panels are getting cheaper thanks to China. So the paybacks are only getting better. And if you don't have good south-facing roof lines, or you don't want the ugly things on your roof to advertise to your neighbors that you care about this, then you can sign up for, again, if you're in the Xcel Energy range with your home, you can sign up for their program called WindSource. And that doesn't mean that you necessarily get electrons directly from windmills. And it actually doesn't even refer to windmills. It refers to renewable energy generally that Xcel Energy produces. And they're required to produce a certain amount by state mandate. But if you sign up for WindSource and you can go home tonight and you can click a few buttons into their website, find WindSource, Google it, it'll take you right there, and you can sign up. And you can sign up in blocks of percents. You can sign up for 10%, 20%, 100%. And the cost of it's pretty minimal.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Those are great. So net metering, this idea that we live in a state where the grid is required by law to take your power that you generate. Also in Minnesota, we live in a state that has some pretty favorable community solar legislation. So if you don't live in a situation where you can put solar on your roof, there are favorable policies where you can get together with your friends and neighbors and act collectively, which is actually pretty exciting because it sits in that space between what do you know, your individual responsibility and how we act collectively. So another thing to do is go home and actually start talking with your neighbors about how you want to get together and participate in solar.
Kate, you have another question over here?
Yeah.
Hi.
My name is Elizabeth Arnold. I have a question about, we talk a lot about contribute to actions against climate change, installing things in your home. But that costs money, and I was wondering if you guys have any viable solutions for people who can't afford that or, don't want to make major infrastructure changes in their personal homes, like maybe waste reduction or something like that.
Jessica?
Well, so a number of things about that. Renewable energy, say solar, for example, even in Minnesota, as we just heard, can be very cost-effective. And in the long run, once you pay for that solar infrastructure, then it's power for free, essentially. I mean, you still have to connect to the grid. But the idea that you need to make an upfront investment, the upfront investment can be quite expensive. And so one of the things that we need are mechanisms by which people can actually acquire the loans. And California actually has a lot of really creative programs by which you can rent to own and, sell, you can lease your roof to others to use and this kind of thing. And there's a lot of creative things that we can do in Minnesota to make the upfront cost of solar more cost effective. That's one idea. The fact that renewable power is sort of long-term cheap power, if you can afford the upfront costs, actually means that in public infrastructure, it can be a particularly good investment. So if you think about things that taxpayers are paying for, you would look more favorably on renewable power because it reduces the operating costs of public infrastructure. So that's pretty appealing. And then not to mention, mostly because of wind, if you build utility-scale wind power like we do here in Minnesota, it's becoming cheaper than not only building new coal plants, but it's actually becoming cheaper than operating the existing coal plants.
And it's creating a lot of jobs, too, in the process. That's something we haven't talked a lot about tonight, but a very positive trend that's happening. Kate?
I'm Jason from St. Louis Park, and my question was, what do you think it'll take to make our political leaders take real action?
do you want to say?
That's a young man without a lot of patience. I kind of like that. Here's my two cents, and Radhika touched on it. I think it's going to take some wave elections, and where climate is one of the major drivers. I think it's that simple.
Yeah, there's something about, a young person standing up and asking that question and expecting it to be answered by a politician is a great start. I think we have to have ways in our political system of addressing these longer-term challenges, too. There's just a lot of kick the can, you know. Well, that is I'm worried about my next reelection campaign, and I don't see what I'm going to get out of really tackling and addressing this problem. So there's not only just the political differences between parties, but an expectation that we want our politicians to be doing long-term planning and building these resilient systems that will help us be prosperous in the future.
And yet Minnesota's been pretty successful with this politically, right? I mean, we've instituted these renewable energy standards. It's happened faster than a lot of people thought it might. Mark, Radhika, what do you think? Can that translate to the rest of the country and nationally?
I don't know. I am encouraged by the... I think there's a big disparity across the generations here, so I am encouraged by the younger people and that the electorate that is composed of that group will have a much more powerful voice in the next two election cycles. So I do expect to see, I hope it's not a false expectation, but I do expect to see some of the other states change over in this regard in the next two cycles.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope we can see this trend keep moving forward. You know, I want to thank all of you tonight. This has been a really eye-opening thing for me, and I love hearing perspective from different people who are working in different areas of climate. It's always illuminating to me, and I hope to our audience, too. Could you guys please thank Jessica Hellman, Radhika Fox, and Mark Seeley? Thank you. A couple of thoughts before we adjourn this evening. You know, I was thinking about how much progress we have made in the last 5 years. Public acceptance of humans' role in climate change has gone up considerably. The needle is moving. Gallup polls have gone from about 57 to 68% in the past decade. And a lot of the discussion really is what we're seeing tonight. It's gone from, hey, are we causing this, to what are we going to do about it? And what are we going to do about it is the ground truth is happening. Renewable energy has boomed in the past 5 to 10 years. 4 states now, Iowa, South Dakota, Kansas, and Oklahoma, all generate more than 30% of their annual electricity from wind power. The U.S. Department of Energy reports 3 million Americans now work directly in the clean energy industry. That's if you include energy efficiency, smart grid, energy storage, renewables, and electric and hybrid vehicles. We talked about Fortune 500 companies increasingly making climate sustainability part of their business model. So I feel like we are making progress globally and locally, and even a little bit here on our work with ClimateCast. I've interviewed many of the world's top scientists in the last 5 years, climate scientists, and we're going to continue to focus on the latest climate science, this growing science of extreme weather attribution. Try to make this real for people on how climate is hitting us all at home. And of course, we're going to be focused on solutions as well. We're focused on the economic opportunities that climate change offers. There's a lot of climate cliches and quotes floating around out there, but this one sticks with me. And it's hard to pin some of these down. It appears to have come from a Shell Oil researcher in a piece in The Economist in 1999. And the quote is, "The Stone Age did not end because the world ran out of stones. And the oil age will not end because we run out of oil." So in other words, we found a better way to do things in the Stone Age. And now the technology is here and has given us better ways to produce energy. I see this as much as a technological evolution as anything else. And, you know, we used to burn coal in our homes 100 years ago. Now it's big, huge power plants. Now we're transitioning to wind and solar. So we're going to find better ways to do this. They're already here, and we can create jobs, grow our economy, and save our climate all at the same time. To me, that kind of sounds like a win-win-win. Thanks to all of you and our amazing guests tonight, and thanks to all of you for coming out to ClimateCast Live. Good night, everybody.